The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Now it's time to hand around the presents. It's nice to give and so nice to receive. From youngest child up to the wisest parents, everyone will bless this joyous eve.
There is more to fathers than meets the eye. Margaret Atwood.
Father is rather vulgar, my dear. The word papa, besides, gives a pretty form to the lips. Papa, potatoes, poultry, prunes and prism are all very good words for the lips, especially prunes and prism. Charles Dickens.
Mom, she's legit, making us chill when we pitch a fit, telling us to share and never to hit. If you can't say something nice, put a sock in it.
Dad, he's the guy, never gets tired of playing.
I cannot think of any need in childhood as strong as the need for a father's protection. Sigmund Freud.
It doesn't matter who my father was. It matters who I remember he was. Anne Sexton.
Parental memoir has become a literary genre all of its own. A genre one of our guests has dubbed patrimoire and matrimoire. From Greg Bellow's account of his father Saul to Maya Angelou's seventh autobiography, featuring a rather different version of her mother from the one we know from her 1969 classic I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, there are certainly a lot of memoirs around at the moment. With me to discuss them are the novelist, poet and critic Bernardine Evaristo, and down the line from Vancouver, André Girard, only begetter, as far as I know, of the term patrimoire, and editor of Fathers, a Literary Anthology, a collection of father essays and poems by an A to Z of literary heavyweights, from Margaret Atwood and Alan Bennett to Winston Churchill and Virginia Woolf. André, let's start with you. Am I right in saying that you invented the term patrimoire?
Most definitely. It's a neologism that I coined, although I subsequently found that scholars have started using a term to mean the same thing. And there's a word called patriography. And I think next month, Stephen Mansfield in Australia is bringing out a book called Australian Patriography. So there seems to be a need or a feeling that that word is usable.
I prefer your word. I particularly like the phonetic version of it, patrimoire, M-W-A-R, sort of like moi, kisses.
Thank you. It's easier to say, and it has no history to it. Patriography, curiously enough, also refers to an American line of patriotic cards that was published in the 1890s. So there's that going for it as well.
And you describe a patrimoire as an essay, poem, play or film built around memories of the author's father. So it's cross-genre.
There are a lot of, films, at least a dozen films that children have made about their fathers. And one other feature of the patrimoire is that I guess it's critical. There's usually a frank appraisal of the parent in patrimoire or matrimoire.
Now, Bernardine, part of the inspiration for this podcast was an excellent review you wrote for The Observer about Maya Angelou's latest memoir, Mom and Me and Mom, about her mother, who is, we know, who's Vivian Baxter, who rather ferocious and casino madam almost. And you write that she changed her story. It's yeah. Basically completely different.
Well, it's quite different. So I read Maya Angelou's first memoir, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, about 30 years ago. And the meat of that story is really about Maya Angelou being raped as a child by her mother's boyfriend who's living with her. And so when I was reading Mom and Me and Mom, I realised that she just completely skipped over this rape and she just mentions it. She says, oh, I was raped at a certain age. you know, she was contradicting herself, basically. So I felt that she was telling two different stories about her mother and about her childhood. In the new book, she gives us the impression that her parents, she leaves her parents at the age of three, lives with her grandmother, and doesn't see her parents again until she's a teenager. Actually, in the original book, she sees both parents when she's seven or eight, including her father. She spends a whole chapter talking about her father visiting her and her grandmother as a child, and the big impression that he makes on her, and she's quite in awe of him. Then in the new book, the father is invisible until she's, I think, 13. And then she retells a story of herself when she's 15. She goes to Mexico with her father, and he gets drunk. She has to drive the father home, even though she's never driven before, which I think is really strange, but that was also in the original book. And then she has a row with her father's partner. Her father hugs her, and she feels uncomfortable. And then her father says he'll look after her. But she sort of implies that her father's behaving a bit sexually towards her. It's implied, it's not stated. So when I then looked at the original experience of her father at the age of 15, she likes her father and she talks about him as a sun god. So I thought, oh, she's really changing. She's really representing her parents in a different way. And I thought that was slightly dodgy.
André, is this something you've encountered a lot with Patrimoine or indeed Matrimoire?
It happens in a lot of writings about fathers, and if I could, I'd like to read just a little bit by Doris Lessing, who, of course, has written quite a bit about her parents. And in the introduction to her memoir, Under My Skin, she has a fairly lengthy passage about memory and truth. Telling the truth or not telling it, and how much, is a lesser problem than the one of shifting perspectives. For you see your life differently at different stages, like climbing a mountain while the landscape changes with every turn in the past. Had I written this when I was 30, it would have been a pretty combative document. In my 40s, a wail of despair and guilt. Oh my God, how could I have done this or that? Now I look back at that child, that girl, that young woman, with a more and more detached curiosity. Old people may be observed peering into their pasts. Why, they are asking themselves. How did that happen? I try to see my past selves as someone else might, and then put myself back inside one of them, and am at once submerged in a hot struggle of emotion, justified by thoughts and ideas I now judge wrong. And maybe, Bernadine, that explains some of the shifts that you've observed in Maya Angelou's writings.
Think so. But I think there's one thing presenting a book as the truth, as you see it. And of course, we know that truth is a very sort of negotiable thing. And it's another thing presenting a book and saying, well, I've revised my opinion or I've changed my mind about my parent. And I think if you frame a book in such a way that, as you know, because Maya Angelou is now 85, if you frame it in such a way, you say, well, I wrote this book when I was, I don't know, 50 or 40 or something, and now I'm a woman of 85, I feel differently about this parent. That's fine, that's totally acceptable. But I think when you're actually telling different versions of the same story, that's when it's difficult.
And one of the problems, Bernadine, isn't it, with Maya's work, is that she uses direct speech.
Yes. Before I came in today, I went and looked at, I've actually read quite a few memoirs, and I went and looked at them to see how many writers do that. And actually, it is a device that a lot of writers do to a greater or lesser extent. In Maya Angelou's case, she does go back 70 years. So we have to accept that she's fictionalizing, you know, because who's going to remember speech going back that far? So that is a problem for me. But then there is also the argument that actually what makes memoir interesting is when they do fictionalize it. They create it as almost as if it is fiction. So you develop characters, you have scene, you have setting, you have dialogue, you have conflict, and so on and so forth. So embellishment and illustration, so illustrating something and embellishing something, there's a sort of thin dividing line between the two. So how far do you go with your embellishment to bring your story to life? That's the issue.
Doris Lessing and Maya Angelou, they have fashioned interest in their stories around their own personas, in a way, as writers. Why generally should we be interested in the stories of people's parents?
I haven't read any of Doris Lessing's memoirs, but certainly Maya Angelou is an iconic figure. She is one of the very few internationally famous black women in the world, and she is perhaps almost after Michelle Obama, apart from singers and actors, the most famous. So she's a very important figure. She lived through a very important part of American history. She did write several memoirs to varying degrees of success. She's recorded her life. She's a poet. She's written loads of books. So
her life is her subject, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, she's also written lots of poetry books, and she was the poet at Bill Clinton's presidential inauguration. So that's an amazing achievement to realise that she was born in the Deep South before the Civil Rights Movement. So there's a reason to be interested in Maya Angelou.
Let's now bring in our interviewee, Emma Brox, who has just published her own memoir of her mother. It has the ripping title, She Left Me the Gun, and is a huge story. But I asked her, even if it is fascinating to her as the daughter author, why should the rest of us care?
It's a great story. This is the thing. I think because I'm a journalist, I think I have been a journalist long enough that I have a grain of dispassion towards the material of this book. So, of course, I find it more interesting than anyone else would. But it's also a fantastic story. It's a story, extraordinary drama. And it's also a story of extraordinary humour. The people in it are all, very eccentric, very charming, very funny, which aren't things that necessarily go with the kind of experiences that they've had. And it's a story of family secrets, which I think is a fairly universal thing. I mean, no one ever knows everything about their parents, and no one ever really thinks to ask about, their parents' history until usually it's too late, because, the life that your parents led before you were born is just simply a hypothetical to you, I think, until fairly late on in your life. So those are the broad universals. And then the actual detail of it is just a very dramatic and interesting story, I think.
Andre, what's your view on this rather vexed relationship between autobiography and autobiographical fiction?
I see the genre coming out of Edmund Gosse's Father and Son. What one sees is these books are acts of self-creation and self-definition. Some of them, are recriminatory. They're just unloading on the parent. They're in the Mummy Dearest Christina Crawford vein. But the best of these books are books in which the writer is trying to make sense of themselves, of their life, of their period, of their age. Books like, say, Philip Roth's Patrimony or Michael Frayn's My Father's Fortune. And Michael Frayn, too, talks a lot in his book about memory and how one constructs one's stories and tries to make sense of the world. I think we can all learn a lot from that.
Now, the Edmund Gosse Father and Son was from 1907. So it's a reasonably recent genre, then, insofar as it is a genre.
Yes, I see Gosse as the father of the patrimoire, as it were. Prior to that, I've not been able to find personal, critical stories about parents. The romantics even didn't address their fathers or mothers directly. And Gosse is the first. And Gosse is, after him, nobody really does it again for about 50 years, although a little bit in poetry. But I think it takes perhaps the confessional poets to open up the inhibitions, to remove the inhibitions. And once the confessional poets start writing, and then we move into more and more into our confessional age and reality television, that's when the genre seems to explode. So that now I keep a running list of such books, and I've got over 235 titles of patrimoires, and I think over 75 titles of matrimoires.
Now, we have very combative listeners, and if any of you know of any earlier examples, do please go to the Guardian Books website and leave your comment on the page of this podcast. Andre, I'm going to just go back to your blog a little bit. You have a blog set up to publicise your father's anthology, and you rather cheekily say that one of your marketing ploys was to feed the patrimoire word into as many conversations and comment threads as possible, starting with Amazon and Guardian Books, where indeed we found you.
I think it provides a very interesting way of keeping track of such books, of comparing them, of seeing how they differ. From a sociological perspective, I think things can be learned about it. Matrimoires, for instance, don't start appearing until at least a decade after patrimoires. And in this decade, there seems to be an explosion of matrimoires. Why are matrimoires suddenly emerging in such numbers? And what can we learn by comparing, say, a graphic narrative artist like Alison Bechtel to someone like Maya Angelou? What are the similarities in the tellings? What are the differences? What are these authors trying to accomplish? So it provides another mirror or instrument for us to sharpen our critical wits with.
Now, one of your guerrilla strikes, let me call them, was on a review of Greg Bellow's Patrimoire. And you came up with a great list of classics in what I would call a subgenre, which is celebrity patrimoire, which is of which obviously Greg Bellow is part. And you characterise that as growing up with a famous writer father. And for most part, they're pretty mediocre, of interest only to gluttonous fans or for scholars looking for fresh biological scraps.
If it were celebrity, I could expand it to books like Mummy Dearest. Children of Actor Parents have also written quite a number, but this was limited, as you say, to children of writers. And they include Dashiell Hammett's daughter, Joseph Heller's daughter, Hemingway's son, Salinger's daughter, Malamud's daughter. You know, there's quite a list here. One of the better ones, by the way, which I didn't include in that list, and I've subsequently added it to my blog, is one by Bliss Broyard, who uses her book to look at issues of race. She discovered when her father, Anatole Broyard, was dying, she discovered that he was colored. So she's written a book called One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, A Story of Race and Family Secrets. He was an American who had lived in New York and wrote for magazines and newspapers and journals, very successful. And he hid his racial background, although he had sisters who remained black, who lived their identity as Afro-American. And he hid that from his family. And it was only when he was dying that he was more or less forced by his wife, who I think was of Swedish ancestry, to reveal that to his children.
Bernadine, this ties in perhaps with Maya Angelou, which is matrimoire, let's call it, as social history. This is an important bit of tribal recollection of where we were.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly Maya Angelou's mother does come over as an amazing woman. She ran gambling casinos in Alaska. She was wielding a gun all over the place by the looks of things. She was a very powerful, very charismatic individual. So, that does come over in the book. But actually, even though she's a character, she's been slightly sanctified in the new version of her mother. So in Mom and Me and Mum, Vivian Baxter comes over as an amazing, incredible woman, almost faultless, whereas actually in I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, I sense there's a more conflicted relationship with the mother, and so therefore the mother feels more human to me.
And shame, it plays a part in The Cage Bird, doesn't it?
Her, yes.
The shame of having a pubescent daughter, a marriageable daughter, and things like that.
Yeah.
Andre, in your list of what I call, wrongly called, celebrity patrimoirists,
yes.
In fact, most of them are women writing about their fathers rather than men.
Writing about fathers, about 40% of the books are written by daughters, whereas writing about mothers, only about 24% are written by sons.
There may be an obvious reason for that, which is that the fathers, at least in this, looking back in history, tend to be the people with public lives.
Yes, perhaps, and also there are differences in the two genres, I think, in what happens. So looking at Emma Brock's She Left Me the Gun, you see she's looking at her mother's history, which is really an interesting one, but she's looking at it in terms of social history and the roles that or the options that a woman had and the pressures on a woman. So she's finding her way, I think, through her mother to look at options for herself. And you see that in the mother books far more than in the father books. Father books, I think, often are investigative. The father is more of a mystery. The father has secrets that are hidden. In fact, there's a scholarly book out by a professor at Reed College, Roger Porter, And he's looked at 14 father books, and he calls his book Bureau of Missing Persons, how the various writers have investigated the secrets of the father, from Paul Auster's father, whose mother had murdered her husband, to former Nazi criminals. All kinds of things come up with fathers.
I wrote a book called Lara, which was a verse novel, which I described as semi-autobiographical, based on my family history. And so it was a book where I began by talking about my parents' interracial marriage in the 1950s in London. So my father was from Nigeria. He came over in 49. My mother was English, white British, brought up here. And when they married, there was a huge opposition from my mother's side of the family to the marriage. So that was the starting point for this book. And eventually it grew to a book that looked at both sides of my family history, which travels from Nigeria to Brazil, Ireland, Germany, as well as Britain, and looked at fictionalizing all these figures in my family history who lived, and one, at least one who I imagine, because we don't know much about him. He was a Brazilian man who lived in the 19th century. So what I did was I interviewed my parents, got all their stories about their marriage, and then I went back into their childhoods and then got them to tell me as much as they could about their parents' lives and childhoods and so on and so forth, and then wrote a verse novel about it. So I was kind of playing with fact and fiction and particularly picking out the moments that were bigger than the stories of my parents. So the book is about migration. It's about lots of people in my family history, including myself, and people travelling from one continent to another in search of a better life. But it's also about prejudice and racism. So, you know, the prejudice my parents faced, the prejudice my mother's Irish grandmother faced when she travelled from the 19th century to Britain, and, you know, there's a lot of anti-Irish prejudice. The prejudice my mother's great-grandfather faced, and he was a German, and he lived in Britain during the First World War, where there was a lot of opposition to German people, and so on and so forth. So the book really is an investigation into my family history, but it's also an investigation into things bigger than my family history, which is what I wanted to do. And then it looks at my life growing up mixed race in London in the 60s and 70s and what that experience was like. And I do call it, sometimes people say it's autobiographical, and I say, I'm almost very clear. And I say, no, it's semi-autobiographical because it is a mixture of fact and fiction. And a lot of it is based on the truth as I've been told. It's based on historical record. So, for example, I went into the Ancestry.co UK website to track certain ancestors, the German ancestor and stuff, and also letters and photographs and stuff. And through that, built a picture of my family.
Why is that any different to any other researched novel? It's basically you've written a historical verse novel, haven't you? But it just happens that your research base is your family.
It's my family. That's the difference, I suppose, yes. I have a scene where my parents make love on their wedding night, and my mother said, well, she was annoyed at that. She didn't mind the rest of it, but she said, well, what would you know about that? So I took the liberty, which you can do when you call it fiction or verse fiction, you can take all kinds of liberties of imagining what my parents' life was like before I was born in a very, very intimate way. So yes, it's a bit like historical fiction. It's a bit like memoir. It's poetry. It's also fiction. It's a mixture of things.
Would you ever be tempted to write a memoir?
Yes, I'd love to, but not yet.
That's a bit of an impish yes there.
Oh, well,
you've
got
stories, I suspect.
I think I've lived a while, and there are lots of things that have happened to me in my life, and I come from a very interesting family. There are 8 children, mixed-race family growing up in Woolwich, very white part of London at the time. And in my 20s, I was a very radical feminist and worked in theatre. So there are lots of things I'd like to explore, and there have been some major changes in my life. So yeah, that's something I will do one day. But I won't be recreating dialogue as part of that because I just don't think it would be honest for me to do that.
But now let's turn to this week's interviewee, Emma Brocks, and her matrimoire. She Left Me the Gun, My Mother's Life Before Me. And it is indeed about secrets.
It
It's a very difficult story to write because it's a story of child abuse, murder, incest, secrets that haven't been spoken about in a family for 50 years. It would be a hard story to write if it wasn't your own family that you were writing about. So there were all sorts of, you know, potentially terrible crimes I could take tonally if I didn't get it right. So I wanted to be in a situation where I was as confident as one can ever be that I could pull it off.
And this is a story that your mother didn't tell you during her life. She gave you hints that her father was a violent paedophile, as she described him, but wouldn't talk anymore.
When I sat down and finally analysed what it was she had done, which is not something you do about, you know, you don't critique your parents like that until after their deaths. And then you try and figure out how it was they came to be the way that they were. And I figured out that my mum must at some time have made a conscious decision that she was going to put a firewall between me and this past of hers that she had done everything in her power to leave behind. I mean, she'd left it geographically behind. She emigrated from South Africa to England in 1960. She had limited contact with her family after that, but more importantly, she had put it psychologically behind, in as much as that's possible. It's obviously not 100% possible, but I think my mum had made a kind of moral and a pragmatic and an aesthetic decision not to let the things that had happened to her in her childhood define her, and by extension define me, which was the thing she was most concerned about.
So let's talk a little bit about the people that you discover. You have to go to South Africa. You go by yourself for 6 months. You sort of hole up there. Mm. And you go and see a counsellor briefly before you go, and they warn you to be careful about respecting boundaries, because this is other people's stories as well as yours.
Yes, that's right. I've never been to a therapist whose first piece of advice has not been respect boundaries. It seems to be the kind of boilerplate piece of therapeutic advice that you get. But yes, I went to a therapist because it struck me that I had had no contact with my mother's 7 siblings before her death. So they were unknown to me. She told me cute stories about them, and she had at some level been very fond of them still, but they just weren't a living presence in my life. So I was going to South Africa to do something which, it struck me, was at some level deeply unethical, which was to go and bother other people's parents with questions I'd been too terrified to ask my own.
And these are people who have had incest in their family.
Right.
So it's a really horrible secret
taboo,
for them,
right?
Too.
It's the biggest taboo. It's the thing that is never talked about. And it had not been talked about in the common way in this family. But I felt compelled to go and try and find out what it was that hadn't been being said for all those years. So as a precaution, I went to see a therapist before I left. And I said, look, I'm going to go and meet people who have potentially never spoken about this kind of thing before. Give me some pointers, because I don't want to have a nervous breakdown, and I would quite like not to make them have nervous breakdowns either. And so she said, you just have to be respectful of their boundaries and try and read the situation. And if you are getting the vibe to back off, then that's what you need to do.
So tell us a little bit about the people.
Well, so as it turned out, I didn't get that vibe. They were, to a fault, incredibly generous. I think because I came from somewhere else, I had a license which no one in their own families would ever have been given. And also because I look quite like my mum, and they'd all been desperately fond of her, that they felt somehow that they owed it to her to comply with her daughter's wishes, I guess. And I mean, I hope, it's hard to tell, but I hope that at some level they found it liberating, finally, after all these years. You know, my aunt is 68 now, and for the first time in her entire life, she has said things to me that she didn't say to either of her two husbands, that her children didn't know about, and she's finally now talking about it openly.
There was a court case, and this is the younger sister who was 12 when she had to go into court and testify against her father.
That's right. She was my mum's favourite sister, who my mum always referred to as my baby, because my mum basically raised her. So there was a 12-year age gap between them. And yes, my aunt Faye was the plaintiff in the court case. And so she was also the star witness. So her testimony is extraordinary, just page after page of this 12-year-old very bravely, very lucidly citing case after case of abuse, and then having to withstand her own father's cross-examination in the witness box in open court in front of reporters, and withstanding his attempt to discredit her testimony.
What was it like for her, for you to confront her with this thing that happened to her when she was 12?
Well, we got through quite a lot of white wine that night, so the edge was taken off. It was like a reunion, even though we'd never met before. It was kind of so exciting for us to meet each other finally. You know, she was someone I'd heard of all my life, and vice versa. And I was sort of standing in for my mum, this parental figure. I mean, she and I, in a way, were raised by the same woman. That's what's so strange. So we almost identified with each other in a sibling-esque way, even though the age gap was huge. So it didn't feel like a miserable encounter, even though we were going, you know, into territory that had never been explored in the family before. There was a sort of underlay of excitement and joy and happiness to be in a room together and to be reminded of the missing third party, which was my mum, who I was desperately missing and who, you know, my aunt loved desperately. At the same time, of course, it was deeply unnerving. But the thing I should add is that the interesting thing about my mum's family and her seven siblings is that each of them has had a completely different reaction to the childhood that they all shared. So it's almost like a psychological experiment where you take eight different personality types and you expose them to the same extreme pressure in childhood. And then you meet them 50 years later and you see the different ways in which people handle this sort of thing. So in my aunt's case, she has complete repressed memory. She can remember almost nothing of the abuse. She has no memory of the trial. So actually, that conversation I had with her wasn't the most difficult of the conversations I had because she has huge gaps in her memory.
Underlying the story, this particular family story, is a portrait of South Africa, past and present. Now, you go there for 6 months, you get mugged, you sort of act recklessly, they think. And there is a history of violence that echoes back down through the centuries and of inequality.
Yeah, obviously these kinds of things happen everywhere in the world. But South Africa does have an extraordinary level of violence, and violence against women particularly, and in that era violence against women and children, which didn't get policed particularly effectively. And it was extraordinary that my mum managed to get her father arrested and taken to court and push that case all the way through to the High Court, because it was almost impossible, I think, in the 50s to get domestic crimes taken seriously by the state. So yes, there is something very resonant about it happening in South Africa and happening in a family where my grandfather's parents worked on the gold mines, lived in a very sort of poor suburb of Johannesburg. You know, he was raised in a shack, but he wasn't brutalized as a child, which is the thing that you always are expected to find, that, you know, violence begets violence. But he was born and raised in a culture which was very violent around him. I mean, South Africa is a place where, to some level, violence is normalized.
Let's move now to the structure of the book. I'm going to start with the title. She left me the gun. She didn't leave you the gun.
I know, she didn't.
It's a cheap title.
I know, I was being figurative. She very much wanted to leave me the gun. The weird thing is, my dad, who was going through box files in the house this week, just found the license for it. So until yesterday, I had no idea what the gun was. It was a .22 revolver, Belgian made, and my mum bought it on the 13th of August, 1957. It's the gun that she tried to shoot her dad with, and she was hopeless. She was a hopeless shot, so she completely messed it up, which is how he survived, and she got him arrested ultimately. But she smuggled it into England at the bottom of her trunk, and it was in the house as I was growing up, and she would refer to it quite often in a sort of jokey, jaunty way. She would always say, "I'm very fond of that gun." She wanted to leave it to me. You know, I had a kind of dim sense at the back of my brain that it was symbolic in some way, although of what, I couldn't have had any idea. So it was this thing in our lives. But then she lost her nerve. Somewhere in the 90s, there was a gun amnesty, and my mum just suddenly decided that she couldn't bequeath to me an unlicensed gun when it was causing this furore in the culture. So she put it in a cardboard box and drove it to Aylesbury Police Station, and now I don't have it.
But she left you the story, which is your gun.
She did, yeah. She left me the story of the gun, and she left me the thing that it represented to her, obviously, was her attempt to decisively eliminate the threat that was posed to her and her siblings, which is very much the way she lived her life, to take action rather than to be passive.
It's very carefully paced, isn't it? So you get to the testimony right at the end. In fact, I almost wonder whether we should have a spoiler alert at the beginning of this interview.
That took a very long time to get right, I think. Part of the reason why I wrote the book, apart from the fact that I think it's a great story, is that I wanted this book to militate against that end of the publishing industry that has become, you know, obsessed with child abuse, the misery memoir that is now a sort of joke in publishing. Not that the stories in those books are any less valid than this story, but they have received a kind of treatment in publishing and in the press, which is that, you know, slightly voyeuristic, incredibly grim stories, grimly told. And I wanted this to be not that kind of book. So I didn't want to front load it with all the most shocking, desperately sad, gory details. You know, there's some really radioactive stuff in this book. And I thought it was important for that to come fairly late on, so that people reading would understand that that's not the takeaway from this book, is that, you know, somebody did something terrible to my family 50 years ago. It's that, wow, look at the people that came out of it. They were kind of amazing and funny.
And most amazing of all is your mother, who managed to make a family of her own in a completely different continent.
She did. And I mean, it was a total reinvention. I mean, up to a point. She was a Buckinghamshire mum. She didn't stand out at the school gate. You know, she did all the regular things. She stood in line at Budgens, did yoga in the village hall. But like you said, you know, there were indications that she was not wholly cut from the same cloth as all of my parents' friends. She was quite loud. She was quite aggressive, camply aggressive. That's the thing. She did everything with a slight irony. But, you know, she quite liked to have a fight. If there was a fight to be had, she would grab the opportunity with both hands. But she did. She very successfully reinvented herself in England. And when you read the book and you see what she was coming out of, it is just an extraordinary achievement.
It's a wise child that knows its own father, and an unusual one that unreservedly approves of him. Mark Twain.
We use our parents like recurring dreams to be entered into when needed. They are always there for love or for hate. Doris Lessing.
She Left Me the Gun, My Mother's Life Before Me is published by Faber. Well, as Bernadine noted in her review of Mom and Me and Mom, memory is a fickle, fictional, fantastical thing. As a rather wonderful footnote to this whole discussion, our review of Greg Bellow's Patrimoire carried a picture from the book which was reputedly of Greg and his father. Not so, protested a contributor to the comment thread. The adorable child in the picture of Saul Bellow accompanying the review of Greg Bellow's book Saul Bellow's Heart is not of Greg, but of me, Daniel Bellow, born 1964. I remember that afternoon well, especially the ice cream sundae my father brought me, because the nice photographer from Life magazine was there. We traced the source of the misattribution back from our pages, via the book itself, to the Getty Archives, where it would no doubt over time have become a matter of indisputable historical record, were it not for contributors to the Guardian comment threads. So do please join them and us in this or any other conversation. You can comment on this podcast by going to guardian.co.uk/books and clicking on the podcast tab at the top of the page. We do look at the threads and follow up your comments or questions wherever possible. If you haven't already, please tell your reading friends about us and do subscribe. You can do so from our podcast page or via iTunes or on SoundCloud. Thanks to Emma Brox, Bernadine Evaristo and André Girard. From me, Claire Armistead and producer Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardian audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.